Well, good evening and welcome to the Wednesday webcast with me, Scott Castanrenny, himself,
Mr. Al Coates.
Al Coates.
Al Coates.
Sorry, I mentioned. Sorry, I didn't mean to say your name.
I have one job and you literally stole it. Al Coates.
It's the one you're best at as well, saying your own name. Let's be honest about it. We're in matching uniform tonight.
We look like the stars had to go. We look like the evil twins in your classroom, Adele. That's what we're like.
Yeah.
And someone who's very jealous of our uniform, Adele Bates is joining us tonight. Welcome, Adele. And thank you for coming.
Hello, I am.
Slightly postponed and delayed, but you're here, and that is the main thing. Because we were very excited to have you on a couple of weeks ago, but obviously it went a bit wrong. But never mind, it's all good, you're here now. So thank you for joining us. Let's crack on. First of all, introduce yourself. Tell us all about you and why you're not necessarily why you're here, but
are we gonna do an advert before we crack on, Scott?
I wish you said beforehand, but I did. Yeah.
Anyway.
Right. Now, Adele, notepad and pen, because you take notes and give feedback afterwards on this. Yeah? Cool.
Fabulous.
Off you go, Al.
So on the 12th of March, Scott and I are giving a small practice day from 9 o'clock till 1 p.m. On Zoom, and it's going to be £25 per person. But if you book 5 tickets, you only pay for 4 tickets. We're going to be talking about the underlying causes for challenging behaviour within an adoption, fostering, special guardianship context. We're going to talk about some of the challenges of working professionals. We're going to be talking about how to support families, but also about practical help for families and looking at some of the stuff families can do. That's going to be a week on Friday, which is the 12th, and if you want, the link will be in the wordly dirdly blurb down below. Oh, that was rubbish.
Yeah.
No, that was good.
Well, it was all right. I mean, you need to listen to the previous ones to know that was good.
I'll make sure you link me in with that on the Twitter machine, because my community would like to hear about that too.
I'll get my people to talk to your people. I'll fax you a memo.
Do it. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, can we introduce our guest? Are you done with your little faffing? Adele, welcome. Yeah. Thank you for joining us. Introduce yourself. Tell us who you are and what you do.
Yes.
Thank you. What's my name and where do I come from?
Yeah. Exactly.
I've been watching that recently, just doing some bit of, watching that, looking back and seeing how uninclusive it is and how a bit like totally inappropriate language it is, but still it's got a siller in. Anyway.
Well, they do it now with Paulo Grady, you know that, don't you, on Channel 5.
It's not quite.
We need to, that should be our theme tune, actually. Anyway, sorry.
I digress this there.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, so
who are you?
My name's Adele Bates. I'm going to go for this. and I'm some randomo they got off the street. So I'm a behaviour and education specialist. So what that actually means is that I have had juice poured on my head. I've been whacked by a skateboard at work as well. And I've taught a year 7 pupil, so that's 11 years old, how to read their very, very, very first word. So what I do is support school leaders, teachers, teaching assistants, and lately more homeschooling parents and carers as well, of course, on how to empower our young people with behaviour needs to thrive in their education. And what I mean by that is, like, I don't just mean help them get their timetables sorted or get them a GCSE or whatever it is, but actually go past that and empower these young people, whether they've got behaviour needs or SEMH, social, emotional, mental health needs, or attachment issues, or whatever's going on, and they help the adults around them to enable these kids to be able to be a part of positive social change. That is my big mission. I am the forthcoming author of Miss I Don't Give a Shit, which is due out. Al, don't tell me. Your mom, she'll be really cross. That's the title of my book. Miss I Don't Give a Shit, and it's engaging with challenging behaviour in schools. So that's out in the autumn. So I might have to persuade you to jump back on and sing and dance all about that when we get there. And
free copy.
On.
Free copy.
Yeah.
And I'm a TEDx speaker 2020, which means we haven't done it yet because we can't do live. But it still feels good to say I'm a TEDx speaker 2020 who hasn't done my TEDx talk.
So all of that sounds like absolutely, because the way you shared that, it just sounds so positive and completely different approach to what we're used to, because we're used to people coming in and going, yeah, I deal with children, behavioural issues, and yeah, you know, I've been hit by a skateboard and blah, blah, blah. Not everybody, of course, but it just sounds like you've gone into this. Yeah, exactly. You like being hit in the face with a skateboard. I don't know.
I love it. I've got some kind of there. No, you're absolutely right. I absolutely love working with these young people. And I am a human. I do get hurt and frustrated and think the world's going to end sometimes. But I love working with these kids. And I used to be an opera singer. That was my original trade. I worked in the theatre and opera.
God, and we're getting a lot tonight, aren't we? This is like a 3-for-1.
Wow.
There you go. And it was funny because I got to this stage where I just wasn't enjoying performing anymore. And I'd always taught alongside, and I taught quite a lot in PRUs, Pupil Referral Unit, APs, Alternative Provision. And even in the mainstream schools that I would go in, I mean, I was often teaching performing arts, and I'd always get given, like, inverted commas, the naughty kids. Obviously, you don't say that. No. But, they, you know, that was basically what was said to me. And I just got this real joy out of working with these kids because there was something about the energy they have, a lot of them, kids with behaviour needs, have a lot of excess energy. And I am able to create a space that holds that safely. And then what got really exciting for me was when I used to be sent the kids that were struggling with their behaviour, and they kind of send them to Adele's class or Miss Bates's class, and I just loved being able to give them a place, especially if we were doing something like drama, to just scream, because why not? Because we all need to scream sometimes, and I was able to hold that space. And then it got to a point where the opera that I did, I had an immersive opera act in which I performed opera in places where you wouldn't usually have it. So, like, you could be sitting having your dinner, and then I'd come over and warble in a restaurant or in a bar, or I did a drag night. I've never been so upstaged in my life, darling.
Fabulous.
And I once sang in someone's bathroom, actually, as well. I got hired to sing in someone's bathroom. I was clothed. So those bits were really fun. But then there's also this other side to opera. I don't know how much you know the opera world, but it's very traditional and very hierarchical and stereotypical, like all the things. And I just got to this point where I was like, you know what, I'm actually having more fun with the kids. I'm having more fun with these teenagers with behavior needs. And so I kind of went, you know what, I just want to do that. And I want to be able to, I think there was another turning point where I was doing this, what I would call a straight opera, as in like a traditional opera that you would think of when I say opera. And there were these two women having this argument about a costume, and it was all just like really diva-ish and really ridiculous. And I just sat there and I just thought, ugh, you know, I was like a pretty woman in a pretty dress singing a pretty song by a dead white man in Italy. And I was like, no, I need to be able to be part of change. There was something about that. Like, I know that I've got this energy and this kind of ability to kind of hold people safely and inspire them. And I was like, yeah, I want to use it with like people who will actually care. And the opera world really didn't. So I decided to go over and do my training. And I kind of always knew that I wouldn't stay in mainstream full time because I'd been self-employed for 8 years. And you go into a school and, whoa, that was a culture shock. After having not had a boss, like, since I began working, and then suddenly having, like, I think in one mainstream school I had 14 managers above me, which was challenging. And then, yeah, and so then I came out of full-time teaching and became freelance, and it was just this natural pull towards. I'd always taught around things around human rights. I do a lot on LGBT awareness as well, and then behavior. And then it was just this choice of like, okay, which one do I want to do? And it's like, well, actually, I love working with these kids. And I think more than anything, I feel like, so like when I looked at the LGBT awareness stuff, I mean, I still do a bit of that, but there are actually some really strong voices in education right now supporting LGBT awareness. I am a fangirl of Sean Delenty. And sometimes I meet him.
I kind of am as well, but he never replies to me on Twitter, so I've just lost interest. But anyway, go on. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Scott. You see, I've met him a couple of times.
Yeah, all right. Because
I did some training with Amnesty International, and he came in, and I was like, Anyway, but this, what I'm saying is, there's some great voices out there doing LGBT stuff. And is. when I looked into the behaviour side, I was like, I don't hear the same voices advocating on behalf of these kids. And actually, some of these kids, I mean, your audience will know, have been through some of the most heinous things that a human could do to another human before the age of 5, you know. And guess what, it messes you up a bit, and guess what, it means you might not quite be able to concentrate on that Dickens quote. And I was just like, why is no one banging the drum for them? And so I kind of naturally fell into this space, and now, yeah, I really enjoy it. And I really enjoy now because I get to work with kids sometimes. And I work often in an SEMH school. And then the rest of the time I'm doing training, advocating. And like I said, my mum says it, you're just banging your drum. I really enjoy doing it.
Stop the accent that comes through every time again when you're talking. Banging your drum.
Yeah. Oh, I'm from Burton-on-Trent.
I was going to say, is that a Midlands-based kind of accent? Yes, I got that.
Okay. Wow.
Well, hopefully, and there's nobody from the opera and musical kind of background listening there, because, you know, we've got my friend Shona White in a few weeks to talk about how her lockdown's been. She's an adoptee. She's from she's West End, lovely, and a childhood friend of mine, actually. So hopefully she's not listening tonight. But I think it's really interesting. And thank you for expanding on the acronyms there, because not many people think to do that. So points to you, Adele. Yeah, exactly. Because sometimes we get told off for saying RAAs and all that sort of stuff. Al, you seem blown away there, mate.
Yeah, I'm just this evening's taking a turn. I'll be frank with you. We're going places I had no anticipation for. So I'm slightly curveballed. And what's unusual is I think we often have people who come from a very different place to get to this place, you know, with spoiling children's behavior. So I'm interested to kind of, you know, I mean, everyone who's like sees you advertised and sees this webcast will go, just tell us what to do. So from a, you know, because that's what, you know, I think like we're doing this day in a couple of weeks, and people are just going to go, words, just tell us what to do. You know, just get to the crux of it. Yeah, PowerPoint, schmowerpoint. What the hell do we do? So, I mean, what sort
actually,
of...
Actually, come and help. Come literally, physically to my house and help me. Yeah, that's probably more.
Yeah, help me with homeschooling. So, I mean, how did you kind of get from this position of just having a natural affinity and kind of, with children who kind of were a bit flamboyant, say, to then starting to kind of unpick what's going on, and kind of was that something you just instinctively got, or have you kind of had to work develop your knowledge, and then how has that impacted on what you do?
That's a good question. So I think there is something about, I mean, if we go right back, my parents were fostering kids. They were doing respite.
That all makes sense now. You should have said that earlier.
See, I'm like Paxman. Right to it, didn't I? Right to it. Sorry.
That was good. So, yeah, when I was very small, they did respite. Like, this is bonkers, right? To me, this is bonkers. My mum was 18 at this point. She just married my dad. He was 21. And they started fostering.
Like, what?
And it was the 70s. I know. So they started doing respite fostering with children with disabilities as well. Wow. And then there was a bit of a hoo-ha in Burton because one of the first kids, I will answer your question now. One of the first kids that they fostered was black, and both my parents are white, and my mum's 18 and they're on the estate and there's all these twitching curtains because Alison's got a black baby, you know. And it was the 70s in Burton-on-Trent, which, if you don't know it, listeners, is a small industrial town where, yeah, things like that didn't happen then. So, I mean, firstly, my parents were amazingly crazy people. Now, let's say they fostered when I was younger, and I have some memories of that. Like, not loads, because I was very small, but I do have memories of that. And then alongside that, so my parents are, and I'm gonna trumpet them now, they are the kind of people who are absolutely salt of the earth and will never be acknowledged for it. My brother and I are what you might call extroverts, and we're always kind of publicly working. My brother's a sports journalist, so we're both very kind of public facing, but my parents are both very, like, they have done between them, I would, like, years and years and years of voluntary work, and it was always with like either disabled kids, or my dad used to work in a children's home for teenagers, teenage boys, and then they both ran this youth club for, I think it was like over 20 years, and it was 50p. It was 50p, see? But you can kind of, it was that kind of youth club.
That was
club
the youth clubs that I liked.
Yeah, but it was the kind of youth club where I can remember going, because obviously my mum and dad were the leaders, but the kids would come in their school uniform, and I said to my dad once, why does everyone come in their school uniform? And he just kind of went, well, maybe that's what they've got, you know? And it was definitely... Alongside that, I was doing things like going to drama club, singing club, acting, you know, whatever. And I think that's when I started becoming aware that not everyone's like me. Not everyone has the childhood I have, you know. And I saw, and like my, and we'd do the simplest things. We'd play snooker, or we'd play that game. Oh, the really good newspaper game. Can anybody remember the newspaper game? Okay, this is going to be the top tip. Your listeners are going to be ringing in about this if they don't know it. The newspaper game is amazing. Have you ever played it?
No, I've never had it.
Okay, get on the edge of your seats. So each kid
thankfully
has some...
Thankfully, it's not got a phone number, so it's good.
Each kid has some newspaper, and then my dad would just say a word, like tree, and then the kids had to find the word tree in the newspaper. Oh. But what I'm saying by that is it was a very low-tech youth, like accessible youth club that it was 50p, but it meant that everyone could come. And, you know, some nights some kids didn't get picked up, and, you know, that kind of thing. And we did things like tent camping and stuff, which was amazing. So basically, and then my mum's worked for social services. She's worked for CAB. So basically I was always brought up with that going on kind of in the background.
Yeah.
Which clearly informed, you know, what I was going to do. And then...
But did that also make you, just thinking about, if you grew up in that environment and you're around it all the time, you're not frightened of it either. So flamboyant behaviour, I mean, youth groups is just, it's like, some of them are like bull rings, aren't they? They're, you know, my experience of youth groups when I was a kid in the 70s and 80s. So that kind of creates an environment where actually a bit flamboyant behaviour is an out, not summit.
I'm really interested in your use of the word flamboyant, Al.
Right.
Can we just unpick that?
That's his PC. That's his PC word for flamboyant children.
Flamboyant children. I like it. You see, to me, I'm a thespian, darling. I'm a thespian by trade. So flamboyant's something very different.
See, I like the word flamboyant. I like it when he uses the word flamboyant because it actually could describe a spectrum of behaviours in terms of. Well, Al and I obviously know each other. So if you put our children, all of our nine children, in a ring together, there would be a complete spectrum. And I kind of get what he's saying with a complete spectrum, an absolute spectrum. And but to me, I think flamboyant is kind of gay, if that makes sense.
All right.
So there's a spectrum of that as well. Not that any of our children that we know of are gay, and if they are, that's fine, obviously.
I have no idea what's going on now. This conversation's gone.
I'll never know quite how to phrase things that way.
I kind of like it.
Lingo.
I've never heard I've never heard it used in that way, Al, in the education world. So this is good. This is good.
Well, it's going to be in the book, Al. You'll get a credit in the book. You're going to get a credit in the book. It's going to say Al Coates, MBE. Yeah.
I'll put it in the glossary, shall I?
Glossary of terms.
SCMA, SCND, flamboyant.
Well, flamboyant is... So you got at some point or other, Adele, you've really got to answer a question.
Question,
like, oh, heck, no. You did.
You're gonna have to remind me.
This was a preamble before you even got to the question. So I was asking you.
All right, okay.
I have no idea what's going on. It's used to like it's like.
Listen, if we're enjoying ourselves, everybody's enjoying themselves. So don't worry.
Is that how it works? Right? Is that how it works?
No, I do recall, Al.
So it was about you getting to have this position where you're in a classroom full of children, and you kind of go, right, I know what's going on here, and you get. Because, yeah, you can manage the behaviour, but there's a bit more to it than that, isn't there?
Yeah, so I think the first bit of training does come from the theatre work I did in terms of there's so much studying behaviour. I mean, that's kind of what being in theatre is. It's studying behaviour, thinking about where it comes from, etc. So I'd kind of come from that angle. And then once I got to working in prison, pupil referral units and alternative provisions and stuff, it was a lot of learning on the job. And what I saw from a lot of it was some fantastic teaching assistants. I have to say, teaching assistants sometimes, Scott's taking a photo. I must say that I have been lucky enough to meet some teaching assistants in my country, Britain, who are holding this education system together, particularly when it comes to children with behaviour needs. Amazing people.
Yeah.
And that really kind of shaped it. And I really think I saw a lot of how my mum and dad had been, but in a more formal setting. In that way. And then when I did my PGCE, I focused, because you get these little modules where you get to choose what to look at. And that's when I started going, actually, this is an area that I want to kind of go into and that I started researching on. And then, I don't know, I think as a teacher, different teachers naturally fall into different things. Like if you give me a year eight, so that's 12, 13 year olds, if you give me a top set year eight, I don't know what to do with myself. I'm useless. They're like, Miss, can I write another page? And I can't. And I'm like, I don't know. So it's like teachers just naturally fall into different areas.
Yeah.
And I just naturally fell into this area, which then meant I'm talking about it, which then means I'm researching about it, which then means I'm learning from somebody else. And then within all that, alongside that, this kind of various trainings I've done around attachment and awareness and trauma-informed practice and restorative justice and all, you know, safeguarding and all those kind of things that come with once you start kind of niching, then actually those things become very accessible to you.
Al, I don't think that's... So let's just... probably whether it has or not, I'm interested to say that I think this... and Al can agree or disagree. I'm interviewing now. It's very similar to social work in that respect, is it, Al? Because a lot of people kind of go into social work and kind of aim towards dealing with certain areas of social work. So you've got like adoption social workers who deal with solely adoption. That is why they've gone into social work. Or you've got all these kind of different areas of social work.
I mean, you have to kind of work.
Is that right, or is that not?
Well, you do a generalised your qualification is general qualification, and then you have to work your way to the point where you can work in that. So for example, like to be an adoption social worker, you've got to be 2 years post qualified to get in, which sets up these impossible loops where people don't know what to do for 2 years. They've got to go and find something to do for 2 years before they can apply for the job that they actually want. So we're not here to talk about social work. We're not here to talk about ask me questions. You're having far too much fun.
No, I'm just saying I'm trying to show there's a few similarities there. Anyway, can we just rewind, because you said PGCE. What does that mean? Because you didn't explain.
Apologies.
That.
Damn. I can remember what it means. It's the post-generalised certificate of education. It is the teaching qualification in the UK.
There you go.
The getting qualification. And I think that's nice. What it means. That's a bit bad, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, I mean, I only read pop-up books, so I wouldn't know what that meant. So I just wanted to double check on
that. Sure.
I think also there's like a pivotal moment that really changed things for me, which was when, so I was straight until I was 27. And then
it's heterosexual, isn't it?
I fell in love with...
Yeah, just for the heterosexuals that don't know what straight means. I don't know. There might be that some. Is. I don't know.
I was a heterosexual until I was 27. And then I fell in love with my now fiancé. And it just so happened that happened at a similar time to me going formally into teaching. And that really shook my world. And I think that... A lot of my friends at the time were like, oh, have you always known, but you've been, you know, stressed, da, 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 da. I was like, no, like, really not. it's just that I happen to fall in love with this person and she happens to have a different shape in her pants. Like, that's it. and Scott's giggling.
I'm just waiting on this finishing and now going, okay, I need a proper drink now.
Can have one now.
I don't drink.
No, that's what I mean.
No, there is a box on Twitter that there's a box on the Apple podcast I'll have to tick when we've finished this, but don't worry, it's fine.
That's fine. We're fine. We've ticked it a few times. We've ticked it a few times, let's face it.
People don't come to the podcast alone.
Sorry, Adele. Sorry. For the banter. I apologize. I keep on interrupting you.
It's all right. So what happened and... You know, I've now discovered since that lots of people have a parallel experience to this, but it was like, okay, kind of, I'd always been in a minority in terms of positions of power because I'm a cis woman. And so I was a woman who was born biologically female and identifies female now, which is what cis means. Uh-huh. And so like I kind of been in some kind of power minority, but I hadn't ever really felt it. And then when I fell in love with my partner, there was just this massive kind of awakening of, I'd always had gay friends because I worked in the theatre, but suddenly I was not represented and I couldn't see myself. And suddenly society treated me very differently. To be perceived as gay, I don't identify as gay, I probably identify as bi or pan, but you know, the world will assume that I'm gay because I've got a female partner. And I suddenly saw this whole other side of being a minority. And, you know, I'm still in lots of majorities and positions of privilege. I'm still able-bodied. I'm still, you know, all these things. I speak English in England. But it was like, hang on a minute. And it really started to inform my teaching, I think, at that point as well. And I started to think, well, hang on a minute. If I'm experiencing exclusion, not belonging, discrimination, systemic discrimination, prejudice, et cetera, et cetera. Then how about the kids in my class who are in different minorities that I don't know about? And so through researching that, I became the lead on equality, inclusion and diversity in one of the schools that I was working. And that was another really useful point because then I got to go on loads of training because that's what happens. And so it was this kind of, again, that kind of honing of it really, like, I really feel like because I do have a position of privilege and because I do have a position where I'm quite confident to talk, actually, I could use this for good for minority groups who perhaps don't usually get those platforms. And I think within, if I'm thinking about the kids that I work with, statistically, a really high number of them are children in care, and yet how many head teachers are care experienced? I don't even know one yet. Please come and let me know if you are one. But it started to make me think, well, hang on, this system in very much the same way that heteronormativity, like that, you know, society is built for heterosexual couples in Britain. And that affects, and then if you're not part of that format in which the system is built for, then it does affect you. And then because I was experiencing that personally, I think it helped me have more compassion and empathy for different groups. And it's like, well, hang on, these kids, maybe they've gone through adverse childhood experiences, ACEs, or maybe they've been through care, or maybe, you know, these things have happened to them. And yet there's nobody in positions of power within my profession, within education, who are making decisions on behalf of them. And I was like, well, of course they're going to miss things out. So I also feel like my job is, I feel like a bridge. I do a lot of work in mainstream schools about kids who, let's say, are on the edge of exclusion. And I do a lot of sharing practice from the special schools into the mainstream schools so that mainstream teachers can be learning. Because the great thing is, and I hope this really, you know, makes people feel better, particularly if you are a parent or carer of a young person with behaviour needs, teachers in general are such an amazing group of people, and they want to learn. Like, we are all students and we're all kind of excited by stuff. So when I go and do my trainings about, and I'll just introduce the concept of triggers, for example, most mainstream teachers are drinking up this information. They want to know because they want to do well by your kids.
Yeah.
And that really excites me. But then there's a whole kind of thing that all sorts of things, like lack of resources, budget, people making decisions about what we're trained on, the access of things that are available. There are lots of things that get in the way. But that's why, I mean, I've done this in my book as well. I've made a really platform for these kids' behaviour needs who are discriminated against in all sorts of ways within their education, but to give them a voice to actually be able to speak and have opinions about their education and things like that as well.
Yeah. So this week is obviously, as you will be aware, and I am aware, and Al maybe, well, he is aware actually, it's LGBT aware. Adoption and Fostering Week. So we've gone from 1 in 12 stroke, well, to 1 in 14 adoptions in the UK 15 years ago, 15, 14 years ago, to 1 in 6 or 7 in England.
Wow.
Last year. So I'm just touching on that because you've just covered it, and we are not doing it for LGBT adoption fostering this week this year because we're too tired. So, but we're doing that. So is there something in kind of advocating for children who require advocating for, clearly, but to go from 1 in 14, 1 in 12, 13, 14 to 1 in 6 or 7, that's a massive jump in a very short time, let's face it, because that's only 12 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. And is that kind of, do you think, I feel like we're going away from education, but do you feel that that's maybe a thing that because LGBT people feel like you've described, they feel like they've been, you know, they're kind of marginalized and they're not represented and all that sort of stuff. Do you think that that's why they've come up and gone, whoa, okay, so we're not going to have this anymore. Let's just sort this now. And it just takes a few people to start it and then the ball kind of rolls on. Is that what you feel?
I mean, like you say, this isn't necessarily my area.
No, so, like, I'm just asking your personal opinion.
This is just my personal opinion, yeah. Yeah, my personal opinion would be it's that plus it's the cultural shift, isn't it? So nowadays for me to say in this country that I have a female partner, I sometimes get eyebrows, and sometimes men start speaking to me very strangely. they start talking to me about boobs, and I'm like, this never happened when I was straight. What is going on? But apart from that... Oh, Al looks disgusted now.
I'm not disgusted. I'm just
going to switch his camera off in a minute.
I'm just totally bamboozled how we got to this point. But keep going. Keep going.
Listen, you should see some of the messages I get to gay adoption dads. Seriously, you wouldn't want to even know about them. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Sorry. I kind of want to ask you a question. Anyway. But what I mean by that is I think the attitude is changing. I mean, I'm from the Section 28 era. Section 28, mm-hmm. for those of you who don't know, who are not in the UK, was the time when our government, led by Margaret Thatcher, decided that the promotion, that was the verb used, of LGBT awareness in schools was illegal and you couldn't do it.
Yep.
So I was at school during that time, but of course I didn't know I was at school during that time, yeah. if that makes sense. And mm-hmm. because I wasn't gay then, right? You've got to remember I wasn't gay then. So I didn't notice it. right? I think unlike my partner, who's what I would call a proper gay, and also, for example, like, you know what I mean? Like, she's grown up realizing that difference. I didn't grow up knowing that difference.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the, to answer your question, Scott, the I think the shift that I can feel fairly safe in most places in this country is going to make me more inclined to want to have kids, isn't it? You know,
I mean,
saying that, it was only a few months ago. I say a few months, listeners, this is 2021. We have no concept of time. It could have been a few months, it could have been a year.
Could have been last week.
Ago,
could have been this afternoon.
Yeah. Okay. Could have been yesterday or this afternoon. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But my partner and I were like verbally and physically attacked in London. And if you're part of the LGBTQ community, that won't be any news to you. But if you're not part of that community, so many people say to me, oh my goodness, in London now, gosh. And it's like, well, yeah, but it does, you know, of course it puts a question on if you're going to have kids or not. And so I think that's the big shift. My partner is from Bulgaria, and I would say they're about 30 or 40 years behind the UK in LGBTQ awareness. And we have made the decision that we can, we're also thinking about adoption as being our route, these early very stages. But, you know, we've already had to make the decision that we couldn't do that in Bulgaria. It would not be safe for us to do that in Bulgaria, and also it wouldn't be legal. So I think in answering your question, it's two ways, isn't it? It's yes, it's one way that LGBTQ people are looking now and going, oh, we've got role models. But also it's the fact that we are being more accepted and therefore we feel safer. It's the same as my kids, they're not all my kids. It's the same as the kids I work with. If we feel like we belong, if we feel safe, then we can start doing things like learning or creating, or, you know, and that's the same for creating a family or creating your piece of art in your classroom. We have to have that basis of safety and belonging first. And I think it's not, and I just want to kind of put our hands up as well to our trans friends and colleagues and community. You know, they're having a really hard time right now. And
very tough for them, isn't it? Very tough.
Yeah, and that must be, you know, that is going to be, I think, a much harder place to then consider things like adoption, because there's still so many other battles going on. And I think as well, the way my partner looks at it in terms of when we're thinking about Bulgaria or the UK, I'm a natural educator, like it's my job, and I will stop and correct everybody and tell them about the Equality Act 2010. And, you know, that's, I kind of just do that. Whereas my partner, quite rightly, you know, she said to me, I don't want to have to be doing that whilst looking after kids.
Too many things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so if that was the UK a few years ago, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think you're right in some ways before we kind of go on to education. Because I'm a Section 28 child as well, and I didn't know until I was 18 that I was gay. So it didn't affect me in a lot of ways, but actually, had I been aware of the fact that it was okay, then maybe I would have been more comfortable with it before the age of 18, 19. So it's kind of, you know, I'm with you on that, because I think that as I look into the community these days, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that it's right or it's wrong or whatever, but a lot younger people are now saying, yes, I'm different, or I'm this, or I'm that. And that's fine. That's absolutely fine. I'm not saying whether I agree with it or not, because that's not my place. I was 18, so I don't know whether that's right or not. But the fact that they feel comfortable enough to say that at the age of 14, 15, 12, whatever age they are, and also the transgender community as well, because, you know, a lot of children who don't feel comfortable in their own body and stuff like that. So it's a really interesting thing. We might, you know, we've gone way off education, but
you have ticked your LGBTQ. Exactly,
yeah. We have, yes.
Boom.
Yes.
So.
See, I knew I'd get right into it somehow. I didn't have to put much into it. just invite Adele on and sorry.
We've only got 5 minutes left.
No, we haven't. We've got ages yet.
All right, we can keep going. Shush. I'm just saying. So
Adele could talk all night, clearly, so it's fine.
This is actually my second podcast interview of the day. I'm quite impressed.
Oh, really? Oh, but this is your first live podcast.
It is. You've been watching my Twitter feed.
I have, yes.
Oh, yes. Always watching.
Right, Al, come on. Some education stuff. Let's go. What's your thoughts? What's your feelings?
It seems a bit bizarre to kind of shoehorn education into the conversation at this point. I'm totally happy with our conversation. But I think you've kind of, like the point I made at the beginning about, you know, people going, yeah, but how do we do it? How do we do it? You know, what's the tips and tricks and all of that kind of stuff. But I think you've raised bigger questions about difference. And I was thinking about, I am a practice educator for social work students, and a couple of them were based in a high school. And we were having this conversation on difference because it's, you know, there's the banner differences, you know, colour, sexuality and stuff. But this idea of these much more nuanced differences that are so much more hidden, and, you know, diagnoses of ADHD or dyslexia, or like you said, the impact of being through a previously looked after child or a looked after child or a special guardianship child. I think that stuff's really interesting to think about how children frame themselves within the context of a school and how that then impacts upon their ability to just engage or just even feel safe in school. And it's not even the LGBTQ plus. Any corrections? Any? Yeah, right, okay. Oh, that was just pure luck, that was. For young people and children who are kind of maybe starting to emerge into that community, I don't know how the phraseology works, but even for their capacity to feel safe in a school environment and then start to be able to focus in any way on their learning, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, the whole system is built around teaching kids stuff, facts. But for some kids, it's just not.
Mm. I'll tell you a beautiful story that really illustrates this, how important belonging and inclusion is. Because so I was working with a young person in a school, and they had never, I'm an English teacher by trade, they had never got commas in the right place, right? It's a bugbear. If any English teachers are listening, they'll be going, oh my goodness, yes, right? They'd never been able to master using commas.
Yeah.
And then throughout the time that I was working with them, they came to me. There were some tears shed. I was the first adult that they came out to as trans, and they wanted to go through that transition. They wanted to tell their parents, etc. And once they had come out to the school and changed the name on Sims, which is always a big thing that schools panic about. By the way, if you're listening, it's totally legal to change the name on Sims, even if they haven't changed their name by DPOL. The amount of times I have to argue this point in schools. But once they'd come out and like the friends had accepted them, etc., with their new name and gender identity, like that, the commas were in place in every single piece of work. Mm-hmm. It was incredible. And I actually sat down with them and I said, excuse me, we've just got to look at this. Do you know how many times I told you about these commas? How you couldn't get it? And I said, and now you can? And they just laughed at me and they thought it was hilarious. But I mean, my theory, my feeling about that has always been, if you are sitting in a classroom not feeling safe or like you belong or you're included or you're welcomed for whatever reason that might be, you can't concentrate on where your commas are going. It's not the top of your agenda. And I think this is the massive piece that our education system can often miss out, especially when it comes to academic, this kind of phrases, academic progress or like how the data is doing or the exam results or, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's really not looking at the core of, hang on a minute, this kid gets triggered when, for example, blinds are down. Let's say we're all watching a video, put the blinds down. Yeah. Well, that could be really triggering for certain children who've been in unsafe environments in the dark, right? And yet then you're expecting them to watch this video and answer these questions, and you're going to tell them off if not, and you're going to tell them off for not listening properly, and you're going to, you know, all those kind of things. But we've got to kind of take a step back. And I think, again, this comes to the lack of representation within the power structures, because there are fewer... which way around should I say this? There are fewer teachers who have been through experiences of extreme kind of exclusion or not belonging or feelings of unsafety who get to be a teacher.
Yeah.
Because to be a teacher, you have to have a certain level of education. You have to have a certain level of privilege. You have to have a certain support network. You have to have a certain level of finances. There's all things. There's all barriers that, for example, let's say a kid who's been in a children's home will less likely to have access.
You have to be able to work within the system as it is as well, don't you? You've got to be able to navigate the education system as is, which negates you getting to a position of power where you can influence the education system. Oh.
Exactly. And, yeah.
Big stuff.
So you've got to sort it out.
Right, so when do we start?
I already started.
9 o'clock tomorrow at my house.
Exactly. No, I mean, this is the thing. Like, you started off, and you're not the first people, actually, funnily enough, to talk about my positivity. And I think that's really important. And I think that's a really useful tip. Here we go, practical tip, Al. That some of the stuff we're dealing with is really big and heavy, you know. And I'll read an EHCP, which is an education healthcare plan. And some of the stuff I read about some of the kids I teach make me cry. Of course they do. And they are experiences that I can't imagine. And yet I'm with these kids. And that is heavy stuff. And I don't want to, for one second, suggest that doesn't have gravitas and that we shouldn't take that massively seriously. And if we are going to influence these systematic powers and this discrimination that's going on, we need to actually have a bit of enjoyment in our activism, I believe, because that is what will keep us going. So we connect with people who have similar values to us. For example, we're doing a petition about something or other, but we're also all doing it while we're eating really nice cake. We gather when we're sharing stories. Yes, we, you know, and I do try, especially when I'm in talking to people who perhaps don't think of these things, perhaps about what some kids have been through. You know, I do make a point of putting it there to make sure people do know. And then I kind of say, and also you can help, and you can make it better for these children in your classrooms to make them feel included. Because if we're going to have the momentum to change things, it needs to be enjoyable. Otherwise, we won't do it. We'll get stressed and we'll burn out. And that's useless. There's a fantastic book. It's called Emergent Strategy. It's not on my bookshelf. I was just checking if it was behind me. But it's by my bedside table. It's by Adrienne Marie Brown. And she talks a lot about this. Her second book is called Pleasure Activism. And I'm going to have to leave you to read that one, Al, because if I say what she suggests to do at the start of every chapter, you might blush. I think that she's got a really good point in her philosophy, because she's talking about, if we're going to make change, make it enjoyable, because then we're more likely to do it. We're more likely, you know, I mean, I don't know, this is just my opinion, but I'm more likely to listen to a podcast where people are enjoyable and are having fun and addressing really quite key issues. If it's always all heavy, it's really hard for me to listen to, and it's harder for me to learn, etc. It's
dull as ditchwater. But it's interesting that you've never listened before.
I think that's why we do it.
No, joking.
Yes, I have.
I know you have. I'm just
teasing.
That's
why she's come on.
That's why she's come on. She vetted us first.
So just, just shush Al up for a minute. So just going back to your EHCP point, what are your views on teachers, teaching assistants, learning support assistants having at least some knowledge of the background of some of these children that we're dealing with? Because there's a really big kind of thing within adoption and fostering and special guardian kinship about the fact that, you know, we send our children to these places where we entrust our children to them, and yet they have no clue what they've been through. They don't know, and they just see it as they're naughty kids, they're little shits. We've used to want to know already, so I can. What's your thoughts on that? What's your thoughts on them knowing that? Do you think that should be done?
I think there's lots of ways around it. I think my personal approach to it is I like to meet a kid first. Mm. I, for me, that's very important in my practice. And it's something, if I'm mentoring or I'm supporting other staff, I will say meet the kid first. And the reason for that is because we have a negative bias. So if you tell me, oh, you're going to do that and it's going to be really bad and it's going to be really boring, and if I trust you, my brain is already wired to prepare me for a boring, bad lecture, for example, right? Whereas if you say to me, oh, I saw that speaker last week, they're excellent, then my brain does that. And I think this can happen a lot with our kids, that our flamboyant children, that they are just...
It's catching.
It is. I'll be doing it in my training soon.
It's going to be in the book.
Copyright. Okay.
Tell you.
And I think that it's really important that we try and avoid that as much as possible. And again, it's worth saying here about cultural and racial differences as well, because the cultural behaviour of certain people is different to other people. I live with an Eastern European. Their cultural behaviour is very different. And I have to learn about that in my partnership. Yay. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is that I think when we first meet a child, we need to connect with them and give them that opportunity to connect with you, just without all that rubbish of somebody else's opinion. And then what I tend to do is I tend to work with a kid for a few sessions or a few lessons, and then I'll start slowly starting to look at a little bit about what's going on. And what I tend to do, and this is my approach, is that I tend to then balance it between because what I've got to remember, and I think this is something a bit tricky for teachers sometimes, is we're not social workers. Okay. So I always come back to, like, Al, oh, see, look, I told you that was going to annoy me. Sorry.
Yeah, it's
look,
the wrong way. Yeah.
That really freaked me out. And so at any point, when I feel like I'm getting too involved in a kid's history or a kid's life, or which can happen because I'm a human and I really care, and that's the same as most teachers, I try and bring it back to, what is my job here? My job is to be able to give the opportunity of the best possible education that this young person can have. Because in the Western world, this education system is the game we play. And if they don't have certain exams, if they don't have certain things, it is harder for them. They don't have the card that our system is based on in terms of employment and all sorts later on. And so I kind of try and do a balance. So that at the very start, I'm often trying to bat off other people's opinions. Because when you first start working with a kid, especially with a kid with behavior needs, there's so many people who want to come and tell you about them. Oh, by the way, don't do this, do this. And it comes from a really good place. And I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
But what I try and do is just sometimes I'll listen, but I try and hold it. And I try and hold it. I try and consciously say, okay, Adele, you've heard that thing might happen. They might try and throw you out the window. Be ready for it. But also try not to, you know, I try to consciously take it out of my negative bias bucket in my head to give that kid a chance. And then as I go along, it's about, okay, is this kid not accessing my learning, right? Why is that? And if I can't work it out, then I might do a massive investigation where I shall sit through all the HCPs, educational healthcare plans. I'll work with the team around the child. I'll chat with a social worker. I'll chat with the carers or parents. I'll chat with them. And it might involve a massive, massive thing. And for some kids, it doesn't. And it's not because those kids haven't been through a lot of stuff, but it's because those kids are in my class, they're ready to learn, and they're actually really interested in the poem we're analysing. And actually, that is my job. And it's hard and like... it's like different every time, and I always feel like I'm guessing, as most teachers will, but that's the approach that I take, that it's a kind of yes and no, but I think really that first impression is so important, to give the kid a chance to not be the label or not be the opinion of the previous teacher.
Well, Adele, we're coming up to the hour, but before we do come up to the hour, what's your one tip for school returns? One thing.
For anybody who's got a child.
Because let's face it, not everybody, whether you've got a vulnerable child or an adopted child, foster child, not everybody sent their child to school while schools have been maybe open and not. Here, they've not been open at all. So we're, It's only special schools have gone back this week. Special schools, they still call them special schools in Ireland, which really irritates me. But what would you be your one kind of tip for a teacher or a parent or a carer of a child with special educational needs in terms of the return school?
It would be where I start. It's the first chapter to my book, which is you. It's all about we need to look after ourselves first. And I think that's still not taken quite seriously enough.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example within an LCMH school, a school for students with special educational mental health issues. So these kids in the schools, sometimes, like quite often, they'll have a therapist they work with, right? That therapist, in order to do their job, has to have supervision. If they're not having supervision as a therapist, they can't be a therapist. That's the model of therapy. And yet there are teachers and teaching assistants who, I have to say, are being paid the minimum wage. That's another thing we're sorting out. Yeah. They are working with these kids for a lot more hours than the therapist is, and, you know, day in, day out. And yet there is not a model of supervision within the education system, not efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something within the education system that I'm definitely advocating for, because it comes back to this piece that working with young people with additional behavioural needs can be really exhausting, right? And whether that's you're a parent or carer of them or a teacher of them. But I mean, the ones I work with, the ones who are excluded, it usually is for a reason. You know, they're not there by chance, and the turnover of staff can be huge. And so I think this piece around we have to make ourselves as ready and as wonderful for these kids as we possibly can, because we're sometimes working with, yes, the most challenging behaviour, but also the most vulnerable kids that our society has. And I think it's our responsibility to be as brilliant and as prepared and as, you know, aware and centered in ourselves as we possibly can be. I think it's our responsibility to do that. And that is where I start with my number one. And let's take that into an even easier, like, do tomorrow thing, because, you know, a theory's good, but let's put it into practice. It might be that you have breakfast for the next 7 days. And maybe maybe sometimes you miss breakfast. You feed the kids. I'm French, you feed to kids. And I say, what do you have for breakfast? She went, oh, the crusts of the toast that they don't eat. And, you know, maybe that for you is the piece. You've got this transition. Maybe you're supporting kids going back to school, whether it's from the teacher side or the parent side. And maybe the thing for you, that like the one self-care piece, and that could be the eating breakfast. Maybe it's when you go to the loo, maybe you take 2 more minutes without your phone to just look out the window. Like, what I'm saying is, what is the actual doable thing? Scott's laughing at me.
I'm laughing because these are like things that I'm guilty of all the time. So, you know, I'll rush to loo if I need to do whatever I need to do. And then I'm like, okay, I need to be doing something else. And you know, you're rushing your kind of daily routine things that you would want to do. So I get that. And, you know, I'm the world's worst for not looking after myself. Absolutely. And Al's the same. And I say that, I would never say it, I say it, because I know, you know, he does his running and his cycling and all that sort of stuff. But in terms of looking after your headspace, that's what's important. So I get that.
Totes.
Agreed? Colts? Cool. Listen, I was just going to say, so we're going to have you back when your book comes out, because we're going to read it once we get some copies. Yeah, and then we'll give one away or whatever. However it's going to work, we'll sort out that.
With a jumper.
We'll talk about that. I've got a mug with my name on it somewhere. I'm sure I can put that in the post here. But in the meantime, Adele, thank you so much for coming on. I'm very disappointed you didn't have a laptop bag on your head, because I've seen that on social media. If anybody wants to know what that's about, just check out Adele's Twitter feed. Yeah, I know, I'm very disappointed. I was expecting a bit more from you, to be honest with you, but there you go, what you do.
Sorry about that.
But this is our last Wednesday webcast for a while. We will be back next Wednesday. Well, I will be back next Wednesday, where I'm going to be starting a new series called How Was Your Lockdown, Hun? which is a play on words from RuPaul's Drag Race, which our course does not get in its entirety. And I'm going to be speaking to adopted adults and adults who've experienced care in terms of how they've dealt with lockdown and stuff like that. So we'll be back. I'll be back next Wednesday. Al will not be here. He's having. He's an old man. He needs some. He needs an early bed on Wednesday night, so he's going to do that. Shut up.
Honestly, I'm going to sit in bed and watch it on my laptop, and I'm going to send him.
He's going to stalk me under a pseudonym, aren't you?
Yeah. Send curmudgeonly comments on Facebook.
Yeah.
There you go.
But listen, Adele, thank you so much for coming along, and we really appreciate it. And like I say, we'll have you on again. So thank you.
Yes, right. And if you want to come and find me, I'm over on Twitter at Adele Bates Z. Or if you work in education schools and want to connect, come and find me. I'm at adelebateseducation.co.uk.
There you go.
Fantastic.
A little bit of a plug there.
Yeah. Boom. Bye.
Night-night. Bye.